I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, 5 years ago, there was a statue of Christopher Columbus in downtown San Antonio, and then it was taken down. The statue was vandalized with red paint after local protesters voiced their opposition to honoring the figure they said was responsible for genocide and slavery. There was a time when Columbus was a venerated figure in our society. He was held up as a man who proved that the earth was round and in the process discovered America. We have cities named in his honor. We have that holiday. So what should we make of Columbus today? Is his mark on history a smear and beyond redemption, or is he a man to be admired? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealth.org.
Ready to amplify your impact through workplace giving? Many employers match donations, doubling or even tripling your support for TPR's local and global programming. Some employers even match gifts from retirees and spouses, so your contribution can go even further. Check if your company participates today by visiting tpr.org/workplace giving.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Which Christopher Columbus is yours? Do you have the Columbus who is the brave explorer that discovered America, or is your Columbus the guy who brought genocide and slavery to the New World? And there are also other Columbuses to consider. There's at least 9 in total. That's the premise of the new book, The 9 Lives of Christopher Columbus, by Matthew Restall. And Matthew, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
Our phone lines are open. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you want to tell us which Columbus do you really, you know, get behind, the guy who discovered America, proved the world was round, the brave explorer, or the person who was basically a not good guy and did a lot of terrible things. So Matthew, we have Columbus Day coming up on Monday, or Indigenous Peoples Day, depending on, I guess, your point of view. How did we end up with Columbus Day?
How did we end up with Columbus Day? That stems from one of the Columbuses. And you know, the way you introduced the book right there, you kind of got us like right into the kind of the heart of the purpose of this book. And what I'm trying to do here is show people, convince people, persuade people that there are multiple Columbuses, and that helps us to understand, it helps to explain conflict over Columbus, but I hope also to help us to kind of move through those partisan positions. Hearing on the news today, the top story is all week is about the shutdown of the government and how each side is digging in heels and pointing fingers. And sometimes when you read stories of demonstrations at Columbus monuments, and people on both sides defending and attacking him, it sort of feels a little bit like that, right? Just the same old heels being dug in and fingers being pointed. But I think that by focusing on all the different Columbuses and understanding their historical roots, we can kind of get beyond that. And one of them is what I call the American Columbus. He's actually, not that it matters, but he's number 8 in the nine lives. And I sometimes refer to him there as the Adam, which is not a term that I made up to apply to Columbus. I found that in the literature from the 19th century in the U.S. So Columbus Day stems from the rise of the American Columbus in the 19th century and is part and parcel of the entire development in the 19th century of a kind of set of rituals in which Americans, which we kind of express our patriotism, including the saying of the Pledge of Allegiance in schools. That also dates from 1892. I know Columbus is not mentioned in the Pledge of Allegiance, so it might seem like an odd connection, but that's when it dates to, that's when it kind of emerged. And the notion of a Columbus Day comes out of that same kind of period. It's often there's a kind of a misunderstanding of, you know, well, has Columbus Day been abolished? Are we going to bring it back? Yeah, what happened there? And actually, Columbus Day has been repeatedly announced and declared as being national. It has been repeatedly made state holidays and then changed and then reverted and so on. So that story is actually a very complex one, and you can't really make too many generalizations about Columbus Day. It is with us, and so is Indigenous Peoples Day, and it depends on what community you are in, which one is currently the predominant one or the only one.
So when I think about Columbus and how he became this honored figure in our culture, I think about how in 1891 there was this mass lynching in New Orleans of Italian immigrants. There were, at the time, Italians were coming to the United States, and they were held in the lowest of esteem. And even in the South, culturally, they were looked at as below even the formerly enslaved, and they were working in the sugarcane fields, and they were being mass exploited and working very hard and just trying to survive. And they had this mass lynching. And it was such a terrible crime. It made national newspapers, and that became a diplomatic crisis between the United States and Italy. And there was this attempt to try to brand these new Italians as Americans. And so they appealed to the president at the time, I think it was Benjamin Harrison, looking for a way to show that they have a right of Americanism as other immigrants do. And it became a story that took hold. I mean, is that part of your research?
Yeah, absolutely. That story is in actually the ninth life, the last of the nine lives in my book is the Italian American Columbus, and that sort of, you know, the book is semi-thematic and semi-chronological. So the chronological part, that makes sense because that's the Columbus that gets invented around that time, right? And so in order to understand why Italian Americans not just kind of latched onto Columbus, but latched onto him to such a degree of promoting and spending an enormous amount of time and effort and money, raising money in towns and communities all over the United States to get Columbus Day parades set, to raise monuments. I thought this needs explaining. It's not good enough just to say, well, you know, of course they're Italian Americans, Columbus was Italian, you know, that's it. There's much more to it than that. And
but it gave him a foothold on being able to claim they should be here.
Yes, exactly. Right. So, you know, the first important sort of piece of that story to understand is the degree to which Italians face discrimination. And I think that there's a kind of a community memory of that in Italian American communities, but not in the kind of larger community. I think we, you know, in this country, you know, even though I'm obviously foreign born, I'm an American citizen, I have been for 30 years, so I consider myself American and an immigrant. Mm-hmm. But, you know, immigrants have different experiences depending on where they've come from and what time period we're talking about. And even though immigration right now is kind of a hot topic, you know, in American politics, we tend to forget the past history of immigration and how immigrants have been treated.
And so I think that when we talk about
assimilated.
I think when we talk about this story, I think it does help people understand who aren't part of the Italian American community, why that image of Christopher Columbus is so important to them, why it's so important to them. I mean, it's critical.
Yeah, they are looking for ways in which they can move from this kind of category of discrimination where they're just systematically excluded from almost everything. You know, like, no, you can go to your own churches. You can't come to ours, you know, schools, businesses, clubs, you know, restaurants. I mean, there was a category of Americans that were discriminated against. And when we talk about that, people say, well, of course, like African-Americans. Sure. I mean, you're talking about an era only right after slavery was abolished through a war. And when we talk about lynching, surely it was African-Americans. These are absolutely true. And, you know,
but there's more to the story.
There's more to the story. And it's just so that, you know, the fact that.
But forget the fact that
11.
Yeah, I got to go to break right here. But we got to get into the fact that their, you know, their figure is based basically on a myth or a lie. We're going to talk about that when we come back. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Matthew Ristall. His book is The Nine Lives of Christopher Columbus. We're talking about different communities have different Christopher Columbuses. They represent different things to them. And Christopher Columbus has had, he was a sailor. He was an explorer. He was a man who did terrible things. All these things can be true simultaneously. So how do we rectify that? So 5 years ago, we had a Christopher Columbus statue here in San Antonio. It became a flashpoint of controversy. People who were opposed, people who were pained to see that statue in such a prominent position in downtown, threw red paint on it. They protested it, and it was taken down. It was returned back to the Christopher Columbus Society here in San Antonio, who had originally donated that statue to the city. So, and now we no longer have that. What does that mean? And how widespread was that? Was this a national kind of a thing, Matthew?
It was a national movement, and it has faded a little bit. But that experience you had in San Antonio is typical of the experience of a lot of towns and cities around the country. Now, in the impression given is that most, you know, perhaps almost all the statues were attacked and taken down and so on. And in fact, in the end, that was not the case at all. It was maybe a fifth or less were actually removed. So there was a lot of publicity surrounding certain statues. You know, there was one in Boston had its head chopped off or his head chopped off. And that those images are still circulating, online. I did hear about the San Antonio one. So it kind of gave the impression that that movement was larger than it was. And I think what's crucial is to think of the date, right? If we're talking about 1992 or the wake of that, then it's easy for us to realize that it was the quincentennial. It was an attempt by various private, public, and government organizations to launch a big Columbus celebration in 1992 that in some way would be similar to that of 1892, which was massive. And that produced a reaction. And so therefore, the protests and so on around the statues made sense then. But why 2020? There's no anniversary date there. There's nothing particular. Oh, well, the crucial thing there is to see how that particular meeting of various things that are happening in the United States around that time leading up to
George
2020,
Floyd.
Particularly the Black Lives Matter movement, yes. And to some extent also American Indian movement, AIM activities as well. But the Black Lives Matter movement that's the crucial kind of parallel story in recent American history that explains why. And therefore, what that does is it suggests that there's a whole other Columbus being seen here. Now this is a Columbus who's being seen as a symbol of slavery, full stop. And it doesn't matter if you say, well, but let's look at this historically and try to connect Columbus to the transatlantic slave trade. Those connections become pretty indirect, right? That doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter in the sense that it's perfectly understandable that from that point of view, Columbus seems like a symbol of slavery. And therefore, you know, one has to respect the fact that seems incredibly offensive. And that's why he gets moved. But one also can see and can also respect the opinion of the Italian Americans who say, well, wait a minute. This is our Columbus who has nothing to do with slavery. Right. We were talking about this a moment ago about Italian Americans latching onto Columbus as Columbus is an icon of American patriotism. So to latch onto Columbus is a way of expressing your patriotism as an American. So that to help Italians go from being Italian immigrants to being Italian Americans to being Americans of Italian descent. Right. But think of this. You said a moment ago how there's many different ways you can kind of summarize the Columbus biography. You could also say he was an Italian immigrant who came from modest background, without, not born with great privilege, crossed the ocean on a ship, looking for a better life, not sure where he was going, but hoping to be able to improve his life and the lives of his children. Now, that obviously I'm leaving out a lot of crucial information about Columbus, but that is actually an accurate way of describing Columbus. That also is how Italian Americans saw their ancestors who made that journey, whether it's, parents, grandparents, now great grandparents, great great grandparents. That is exactly, you could also be describing them. So the statue, the monument to Columbus at Columbus Circle in New York City, I know it's far away from where you are, but it's one I wrote about in the book because it was so obviously and still is so obviously an Italian-American monument. The inscription at the bottom is written in Italian as well as in English. And it so obviously shows how the people in New York in the 1890s when that statue was put up, who were recent immigrants. Most of them now, we're just not talking about people remembering what their parents did. We're talking about these people themselves identifying with Columbus on that level. And the history of the transatlantic slave trade for them is completely separate, has absolutely nothing to do with that. So, once you can kind of see how far apart these Columbuses are and the stories that are kind of connecting to the people who support them, I think it becomes more understandable as to why there's this disconnect and why there's this conflict. Understanding the conflict is the first step towards being able to resolve it in some way.
So a lot of people say it's unfair to judge Christopher Columbus of that era to the standards that we have today.
Yeah.
But even in his own day, his behavior was so shocking that even his own contemporaries were, couldn't abide by it. And he eventually was imprisoned for it. So, so is that true?
I would argue with that, but I...
Okay, well, I want to hear it.
Just as a historian.
Yeah.
I would argue with it as a historian, not to take a position on sort of defending Columbus, but just as a historian, so he is arrested and he's shipped back to Spain to face the monarchs for his conduct. But what he has done wrong is he has failed as a governor of the colony. He has failed to prevent the Spanish colonists from fighting among themselves, from abusing indigenous peoples. He simply has not successfully managed that colony in a way that it has become peaceful and profitable. And that's what the monarchs expect. They don't really understand what it's like over in the Caribbean. They certainly have not been there. No Spanish monarch is going to go to the Americas during the period of the Spanish Empire. And so they are simply listening to the reports that are being given to them. And it becomes pretty clear that, however much he's to blame and his brother, Columbus's brother, Bartolomeo, how much they are to blame or not, the fact is that this is not a peaceful, profitable colony. The buck stops at the guy in charge at the top, and that's him. So I would take issue a little bit with the idea that he's a particularly bad character. But it's not my motive.
That's going to get some pushback.
I want to defend Columbus. It's because I think that's a distraction from understanding how deeply rooted the system of imperial expansion was. That there's a kind of a momentum of imperial expansion that is based upon invading other people's countries and using religion as a justification to take their countries, subordinate them, and if they don't cooperate, enslave them.
Right. So there's a lot there, and we got to.
There's a lot there.
We got to dig into that, particularly. You know, I mean, he killed a lot of people, you know, and we got to get into that. And we're going to talk more about, you know, what are we celebrating really on Columbus Day, and how is Columbus so much part of the American DNA, Washington, D.C., District of Columbia. It's right there. It's so much of who we are. So more on that when we come back from the break, the nine lives of Christopher Columbus. Matthew, hang with us. We're going to do some pitching for our public radio station. So this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
And I'm Dwayne Brown.
We normally bring you the NPR newscast each hour, but today we're here with something different.
That's right. We're sharing some recent NPR donor comments from listeners all across the country, like William in Arizona. He donated because the truth matters. I couldn't have said it better myself, William.
Anita in Maryland says, free and fair news is important for me and those in my diverse community to thrive and understand one another.
Biora in Florida donated to support, quote, dependable, informative, brave reporting. I could go on and on.
Okay, we'll end with Joe in Kentucky, who says, I can't imagine a world without public radio.
If you can't imagine a world without public radio either, please join the community of NPR network supporters and give to this station today.
Here's how, and thank you.
You can give us a call, 800-622-8977. That's how you can become a supporter of Texas Public Radio. You can also do it online at tpr.org, or you can fire up that wonderful TPR app and do it right there. I'm David Martin Davies, and this is the TPR Fall Fundraising Drive, asking you to take a moment to think about how we connect people, how we build a community, how we try to understand others. It's all about perspective. Not just your own, but others. And how can we incorporate that into really building a strong community? It's all about understanding. And the only way to understand people is to listen to them. And that's what we're trying to do here on The Source, day in and day out. And I appreciate you listening and telling folks about it and telling me that what you like about the show, because that's how we figure out how to do a better job. You can also give us a call, 800-622-8977. And with me in the studio to tell us more is Dan Katz.
And thank you so very much. Thank you for listening. This is an important time because we are in a challenge. We have $5,843 left to go in order to meet our challenge from Guillermo Nicolas. Before 3 p.m. today, we need to raise that money to stay on track. We want to give a big thank you to Catherine Hill and her pet Sunny for making a monthly donation in support of TPR. Catherine says that Sunny enjoys TPR news and classical music with me, and also as company when I leave the house. Four enthusiastic paws up. We'd also like to thank Robert Jones and Larry Verner for their support of TPR. Larry says, thanks for being here. And we're thanking you for being here for us during this fall membership drive. It's about us coming together to support this kind of reporting. And while we are fighting for our lives here at TPR, some of the reporting we do truly means life or death. And one of the stories that you've been working on for years now has reached a critical point today. Dave, do you want to talk about your reporting on the case of Robert Roberson?
Sure. Robert Roberson is on Texas death row. I've interviewed him twice. I've been telling his story. A lot of big questions about whether or not actually there was a crime. He was convicted of killing his two-year-old daughter, Nikki. There is a lot of evidence that shows that Nikki actually died from an illness. She had double pneumonia. She was had a lot of health issues, and doctors had given her the wrong medication, and she was turning blue, and she died. And they said, Robert, you did this. This is shaken baby syndrome, which we now know to be junk science. It's very difficult to be able to tell if a child was shaken to death, especially if you don't find things like broken bones and torn ligaments and things like that, which were not present here. So I have been covering this story. There's a lot of interest in it. And today the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals gave Robert a chance. They stayed the execution. The execution was supposed to happen a week from today. I was planning to be in Huntsville to cover that execution and do more reporting for TPR and NPR on this story. But now that's not going to happen. But he hasn't been granted a new trial just yet. His case has been remanded, taken back to his original district court, and they're going to look at it and see if there is a new trial is necessary, or whether or not they can just find him to be innocent. There's a lot going on. It's going to take more reporting, but we can't do this reporting without supporters. We got to have help. I mean, it's difficult for me to go to death row and try and talk to these people. It helps me to know that you're with me, knowing that supporters have ponied up and helped us keep public radio strong. So I really do appreciate that, and you can do that right now. 800-622-8977. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Christopher Columbus. Columbus Day is Monday, or Indigenous Peoples Day, depending on where you look at things. There's a new book out, The Nine Lives of Christopher Columbus. Matthew Ristall is with us. He's the author. He's a noted historian covering this area. And you can call in with your questions and comments about Christopher Columbus. Do you think he's a hero, or is he a villain, or is he a mix of them both? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So how do we celebrate Columbus Day? How am I supposed to celebrate it? You know, I usually eat spaghetti. Is that the right way to celebrate Columbus Day?
If you have Italian-American ancestry, then that's exactly the way you should celebrate it with, you know, it's about that, right? Not really about Columbus. Columbus, of course, was not eating spaghetti, right? Italian cuisine, ironically, is unimaginable without the ingredients that came from the discoveries in the New World. Like, for example, you know, tomatoes, which that word is from the Aztec word. They come from central Mexico. That's going to be discovered after Columbus's lifetime. So there's all kinds of ironies and twists in there. I mean, if you're celebrating Columbus Day and you're celebrating Italian-American ancestry and heritage, and October is Italian-American Heritage Month, right? I thoroughly support that, just as I support any community in the United States celebrating their heritage without other people being offended by that, right? The problem is Columbus represents other things because there are many Columbuses. So I believe there's a statue in Chicago that came under attack and was taken down and moved. And I believe they're now building a sort of a museum basically around that statue. And the museum is dedicated to, you know, the history of Italian migration and the Italian American heritage in the United States. I don't know how you feel about that. That seems like a really good solution to me, that there's a recognition of what kind of Columbus statue that is and what he represents. And rather than that simply being destroyed and erased, there's still a place for people who see that statue as representing their identity. They can still go see that. And others can go see it as well. I love the idea that, say, the children of people who demonstrated against that Columbus statue are taken there as school children to see the statue, and then it's a teaching moment. Like, who was this guy? Why do people have different opinions of him? How is it that there are different Columbuses? Maybe for school children, we're talking about you know, middle or high school, not elementary school. This is getting a little complicated, but it's a way. There's a sense in which Columbus is a way for us to think about the history of the last 500 years throughout the Atlantic world, and also really particularly the history of the United States, and to understand how those two things can kind of connect. What Columbus did 500 years ago, he never set foot anywhere in the United States. It seems really disconnected from the history of us up here in the last 250 years. But of course, that's the whole point. They're intimately connected, and seeing how those connections developed is so important to be able to really understand, well, the nine lives of Christopher Columbus. See, there I got the book title.
good plug there. Let's go to Aaron on the phones. The number is 833-877-8255. And Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, David. Thank you so much for taking my call. I want to ask a question of your guest. Family lore has it that one of our ancestors is actually part owner of the ships that brought Columbus across. If he wasn't an ancestor, perhaps it was the same surname. And that surname is Quintero, Quintero. Can your guest confirm that for us?
Wow. Aaron, thank you for the call. Quintero.
Yeah. Off the top of my head, I would say yes. That there was definitely a Quintero on the first voyage. And off the top of my head, I would say I'm pretty sure that one of the owners of one of the ships was a Quintero. Now, I'm not completely sure if that was the first voyage or the second voyage when there were a lot more ships, right? But yes, I do. I actually think either the first or second voyage there was a Quintero. Now, usually the owner of the ship would then serve as the captain. And if I'm remembering rightly, he served in another role on that voyage because a relative of Columbus's instead served as a captain. But yeah, if you're a descendant from the Quinteros of, I think they might have been from Palos or certainly from that region, that south western region of Spain, of Castile, of Extremadura down there, then that would be one of your ancestors. Now, and you probably, here, just to kind of fuel the fire a little bit here, there's a tradition in Spain that goes all the way back to Columbus's lifetime, indeed dates from that very first voyage, that says that actually the Pinzon brothers, Pinzon or Pinzon, P-I-N-Z or Z-O-N, that family actually is responsible for the discovery of the New World. I mean, they certainly put up more ships and more people. I mean, in terms of the kind of the material contribution to the voyage, theirs was far greater than Columbus's was. But this, according to this tradition, it was really the Pinzones that kind of did the work and did the work of discovery and so on. And that battle, that is a legal battle that essentially goes on for hundreds of years because the Spanish government kind of buys that argument to the extent that the claims by the Pinzon family then become taken over by the Spanish government in their lawsuits with Columbus's descendants. And I believe that somewhere in that battle, the Quinteros get included as well as being, hey, wait a minute, but, you know, he owned the ship and he was on board and there were other relatives of Quintero as well. I can't remember. They were brothers or cousins, but that was absolutely what you would expect, male relatives. And therefore they should have some kind of credit and get some piece of the income and so on.
Let's go to another caller, and we have Joaquin on the line. And Joaquin, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm driving. I have a bit of a Spanish accent. I'm from Spain, and I grew up with Franco, and Columbus was a great hero. The comment I want to make is that as far as I know, Columbus initially was just a sailor, and he was a tradesman. He wanted to find a way to fight the Portuguese trading and going to the West. The question of conquest is something later on. So I don't know how much he became so bad because of ignorance, but I don't think he was a conquistador or a person trying to destroy anything initially. That's my comment.
All right, Joaquin, thank you for your call. And so he sailed to the West thinking that that was going to be a shortcut to the Indies. And we always know that he thought he had landed in India and called the native peoples Indians. Is that part true?
Yeah. Let me respond to Joaquin's comment, because I like that comment. It was really interesting. And especially coming from, you know, a Spaniard who grew up with the idea of Columbus as a hero, but in a different way that Americans do, right? Americans grow up with one Columbus, and Spaniards would grow up, especially if you grew up in the Franco years. And I lived in Madrid as a child in the Franco years as well. I know it doesn't sound like I did, but I did. That was an important part of my childhood. And so I was also introduced as a child to a kind of a heroic Columbus, but very much a Spanish one, right? But what Joaquin said about him not being a conquistador is really actually very insightful. What I would argue is that no, Columbus originally is not a conquistador. He's a merchant. That's where he comes from. That's his mentality, is to explore and to trade. But because the phenomenon of expansion is an Iberian one, it's the Portuguese and the Spaniards in competition with each other, and it's Spaniards who are responsible for his voyages, he essentially is forced to become a conquistador. He has to kind of change his expectations and what he's doing. He wants to be in charge. He wants all the rewards. Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, within the Spanish system, you're a governor. You're a conquistador settler.
But, I mean, he's the original conquistador.
Well, in a sense, except the whole concept of the conquistadors already exists because the Spaniards have been being conquistadors in their own peninsula. And in 1892, finally conquer the last Muslim kingdom. So there are veterans of wars in the Iberian Peninsula, of wars actually in Italy, because Italy is kind of the battleground for European states, right? It doesn't exist as an independent state. So there were veterans of those wars and also of the battles of expansion into the Atlantic, where Spaniards and Portuguese are battling each other. And if there are people already living on those islands, like in the Canary Islands, they're battling them. So, you know, he's the original conquistador. That's actually a very rhetorical way of putting it, because he is accompanied by conquistadors who are Spanish conquistadors. And particularly by the time we get to the second voyage, these are people who have, these are veterans of wars. And this is, in a sense, a war. That's the way we should probably think of it, of what happens in the 1490s. It's a war by Spaniards against whoever they find who is not going to cooperate, right? And against indigenous peoples. Columbus doesn't create
it's described as a slaughter.
Yeah, there's, I mean...
All right, so I got to take another break here. Yes, well, sure. I want to get into that part because really want to have a clear-eyed view of from you, an expert, you know, what actually happened with Columbus when he arrived and the people he encountered and how brutal it was. And our phone number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you had a question or a comment about Christopher Columbus, here's your chance. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty with Matthew Ristall. He's the author of the book, The Nine Lives of Christopher Columbus. So was Christopher Columbus this bloodthirsty brute who showed up on the shores of the New World and just began slaughtering people?
No, but I like how you're phrasing the questions. I mean, this is not your first rodeo, right? You're phrasing the questions in a way that leads me into an answer that I don't really want to give. So no, he was not that person. And that makes it seem like I'm out here to defend Columbus, and I'm really not. What I'm trying to do is constantly redirect the discussion away from him to kind of to the larger phenomenon.
Well, people want to know, I mean, should I hate this guy? Should I revere this guy? And I mean, it helps to know what he actually did.
Yeah, and also what he was actually like. So, you know, when I set out to write this book, I thought, I'm not sure if I have a clear sense of what he was like as an individual. You know, let's just kind of trivialize it and say, is he someone you would want to have over to your house for dinner? Would that be an interesting conversation? Is he a pleasant person to have around and so on? And I was prepared to be surprised at him perhaps being kind of likable.
Well, he was able to charm the knickers off of Queen Isabel, didn't he?
Well, which is also something that I realize is not true at all, right? And so that kind of undermined that possibility. But also I was prepared to come to the conclusion that he was a horrific person. He was monstrous. And when I studied Hernando Cortez and wrote a book that's largely about Cortez, you mentioned it earlier, called When Montezuma Met Cortez, I think you mentioned it. I came to the conclusion Cortez was a monster, an absolute monster, and absolutely would not have wanted that person anywhere near anybody that I cared about. I did not come to that conclusion with Columbus. I found him unlikable. I found him kind of a bore, so sort of boringly self-obsessed, sort of obnoxiously narcissistic. And I think that kind of middle ground, you know, in my mind of someone who was not not kind of this, not a saint, but also not kind of a Satan either, it helps us to kind of understand what happened in the New World and what he did. He made poor decisions. Sometimes he did act with violence. When he didn't know what was going on, when he couldn't control things, he tended to resort to violent solutions and would have, you know, other Spaniards arrested and tortured and so on to try to control the situation. But you know, how did the Caribbean spin out of control into violence, and when exactly does that happen? Interestingly, and again, you're going to think now I'm defending Columbus, but I'm just telling you the this is the historical fact: is he left behind a number of Spaniards on the island of Hispaniola, which the island that now where Haiti and the Dominican Republic now are. And the spot he left them behind on is, which is now in the Dominican Republic, because one of the ships had run aground and they had to break that ship up. So only two of the three ships made it back. And so they left, most of the crew from that ship were left there to build, you know, to found a city, a Spanish city, to kind of build a stockade and so on. By the time Columbus comes back, less than a year later, on the second voyage in a much larger expedition, all of those Spaniards are dead, right? So what happened? Well, you know, well, at first they assume, well, this was obviously the indigenous peoples, the Indians. They're savages. You can't trust them. They must have killed all of our people and so on. But there's, you know, something of an investigation, and they begin to realize that that the Spanish settlers started making demands. You need to provide us with food. You need to provide us with labor. We need labor to build structures, to build houses and public buildings. Also, we need some kind of immediate return on our investment. So where's the source of precious metals? There appears to be gold in the rivers. Like, you could do kind of placer gold mining. So all of these demands, they increase and they increase. And indigenous peoples, understandably, are a little resentful of these foreigners who just show up and then decide to settle and start making these demands. And violence breaks out, and the indigenous peoples are not united. They are in their own small polities or kingdoms. So there's rivalry among them. There's rivalry among the Spaniards. It's an absolute mess. And it means that from that moment on, the process of colonization in the Caribbean is violent, and it becomes brutally more and more violent. And when Spaniards show up, they want revenge on the Spaniards that have been killed. And I don't have to, you know, even somebody listening who doesn't know anything about, you know, the Caribbean in the 1490s and 1500s, but maybe has followed events in Eastern Europe or in the Middle East or something like that, you will be able to understand how that happens, that whatever the original causes of a conflict become lost, and it simply becomes kind of one act of revenge and against another, with Spaniards attempting to settle and establish a colony. They're not backing down from that. And indigenous peoples, you know, understandably not backing down from the fact that, no, this is where we live. This is our land. So does Columbus help make this any better? No, not at all. Does he make decisions that seem to very much place him kind of on the wrong moral side of this process? Yes, absolutely. But does he start it? Does he invent it? Does he come up with any of this? Does he promote new ideas to do with slaughtering and enslaving indigenous peoples? No, absolutely not. And I think it's important to understand that he's part of a process. And to, only by understanding that process can we understand what is wrong with, you know, an international slave trade. What is wrong with colonialism? What is wrong with invading someone else's country? It doesn't matter whether it's today or 500 years ago. You go and invade someone else's country and send armed people, warriors, soldiers, and so on, into people's houses where there are families. That's just, that's wrong in any era. That's wrong.
Matthew Ristall, he's the author. He's a lot of great books. The Nine Lives of Christopher Columbus. Thank you so much, Matthew.
Thank you.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Kenny Malone from Planet Money. And you may already know that Congress has ended federal funding to public media.
Kenny.
But no matter what...
Kenny.
I'm sorry, are you me, but from the future?
Yes.
Your voice is... time travel side effect. I wanted to say
he said something
thank you.
About...
Well, for...
signing up as a sustaining member.
Like signing up to support our beloved public radio station with automatic monthly contributions?
Yes, yes. We had always wanted to give, but we just never got around to it. Then you signed us up as a sustaining member,
and we never had to think about it again. That's a classic. Classic economic nudge, and now we just continue our support of public radio just like we always wanted to do.
Exactly. Yeah. Future you is here to say thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And present me is here to tell everyone that no matter what's happening today in public media funding, you can take control of this station's future by becoming a sustaining member today. And future you will thank you.
He's right. Here's how to do it.
The number is 800-622-8977 or visit tpr.org to join today. And this is our fall pledge drive. I'm David Martin Davies, and you're listening to public radio right now. So if you're not supporting it, I got to say, well, maybe you ought to think about that because we really do need your help right now. If you've already just heard just now, all federal funding for public broadcasting has been zeroed out. It's been eliminated. It is zilch. Through an act of Congress, public radio's accessibility relies on your support right now. Give us a call, 800-622-8977 or visit tpr.org. And with me in the studio to tell us more, Dan Katz.
And we are in an important challenge right now issued by Guillermo Nicolás, who is a friend of the station, a supporter of the station, a big philanthropist in our community, a supporter of local news. We have $4,746 left to raise by 3 p.m. That's by the start of All Things Considered, in order to stay on track and raise $1 million for public broadcasting to keep it strong and sustainable in our community. We'd like to thank Frank Toback, as well as Terry Torres and her pet Darla, puppy girl Torres, for supporting TPR. Darla shared this sweet message. My human and I listen every day and love everything you do. Thank you so much. Join your fellow listeners right now. Join the more than 13,000 people who realize that listener support is what makes programs like The Source possible. Now, Dave, we've been talking about the case of Robert Roberson, one of the biggest national stories of the day, a story that you've led reporting on nationally across multiple platforms. And one interesting thing that an interesting twist this past summer is you've had a collaborator take an interest in the case and in your reporting.
I think you're talking about John Grisham, the famous writer. He usually writes fiction. He's a lawyer, and he writes these thrillers, legal thrillers. But he's also very much involved in the Innocence Project, and he reached out to me and asked me if I was going to go interview Robert Roberson on death row, if he could tag along. And we said yes. We actually... had to make him an employee of Texas Public Radio. We didn't pay him anything, but, you know, he's an employee of Texas Public Radio in order so we could get him into the media room to talk to Robert Roberson with me. And it was an interesting experience to be able to do that. I hung out with him for several days as we worked on the story together and we talked to people and checked into things. But this is... just part of how big this story was that John Grisham wanted to, he's writing a book about it. He's looked at my reporting and he's very like, well, how do we tell the story about there's a man who is likely innocent in the state of Texas, had been up until this morning very much interested in trying to kill him. So that has changed because the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals today granted Robert Roberson a stay. There's a lot more to the story. I need to tell this in another format on another day, but it's really interesting, Dan.
But can you talk about how much it has taken over the years to stay on this story with all that you do and your very robust story queue of reporting and hosting?
I mean, it has been hard. But if anyone's listening right now and you wonder, if I give you, you donate to Texas Public Radio, you know, I want you to know I work very, very hard. And you would be amazed at all the hours and effort that go into, you know, providing news and content. If you're wondering, does my donation, do we earn it? Yeah, we earn it. I work very, very hard. And I want you to know that and be confident that we're going to remember you, we're going to honor you, and we recognize that your dollars are important, and so support us, 800-622-8977.
And you listen for the passion of the journalists like David Martin Davies and across our network. 800-622-8977 is the number to support it and to make sure public radio stays strong. And thank you.